I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as a super advanced AI that is displacing the jobs of 20 other tech journalists in San Francisco, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is someone I've known for a long time, Kai-Fu Lee, the CEO of Sinovation Ventures and former president of Google China. He's also the author of a very important new book about artificial intelligence called AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order. Kai-Fu, welcome to Recode Decode.
Thank you, Kara, or AI, should I say.
So there's lots of things I want to talk about with you, but let's get people up to speed on who you are. I've known you for a long time, and I remember when you were hired. I think I wrote a story in the journal at the time that you were hired. So talk a little bit about your background so people can get a sense of where you've come from.
Sure. I grew up in the U.S., mm-hmm. Columbia, Carnegie Mellon PhD, and then I ran multimedia at Apple, mm-hmm. followed by SGI, Microsoft, where I started Microsoft Research in Asia.
Right.
Back at the headquarters, worked for 5 years. Mm-hmm. In Redmond, mm-hmm. and then I went to start Google China in 2005.
Right. So talk about how you got there. So because you had obviously a very storied career. You had a lot of great spots. Multimedia at Apple was a critical job. That was back in the 90s?
In the 90s, 90 to 96.
Yeah. Which was their recovery period, really.
When they were a difficult period.
Difficult, yeah. Kind of stuff. So you had long time Silicon Valley. Why did you do China for Google? You went over there in what year?
In 2005.
2005, which is early in Google's, when they were involved in China.
It was the initial entry.
Right.
But I was at Microsoft Research China mm-hmm. in 98.
Right.
So that gave me the experience.
Sure.
And that's presumably why Google tapped me.
And what was your goal there to do? What was at the time when they were entering and then they exited? But talk about your goal. What was the goal for Google there?
Well, the goal was to build up a local presence, mm-hmm. win as much market share as we could, mm-hmm. and stay true to the corporate values.
Right.
And all three of which we accomplished.
Right. And you located servers outside of China. There were all kinds of different things you did. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it's going to be relevant to what we're talking about later.
Sure. Well, the Chinese laws required some servers to be present in mm-hmm. China, so mm-hmm. we had that. The majority of the servers were outside, mm-hmm. and then there were certain commitments that Google made mm-hmm. in order to do censorship and be present in China.
Right.
Things like providing an explanation whenever something was removed.
Right, at the bottom.
At the bottom, and also providing an uncensored search, and also... not store personal information in China.
Right, which they didn't. They didn't allow people to register, essentially.
That's right.
Correct. And one of the interesting parts was putting that, saying this was, if someone was doing a search, at the bottom saying things were left out of the search due to laws of China, correct? Something like
that. Yes, and actually all search engines ended up doing that.
Right, right. And yeah. It was because the idea was that you didn't pretend that you weren't censoring things, correct?
That was the idea, yeah.
That was the idea. Now, that was a Chinese government idea or a Google idea?
Both were okay with it.
Both were okay with it. Now, so you were there until how long?
For 4 years.
4 years. Mm-hmm. That were you there during the pullout or
no? No, I left 3 months before that.
Right.
And I had no idea that was happening.
Oh, you didn't? Really?
No.
You weren't aware of that?
Well, you saw the later reports that mm-hmm. they saw things in November and
right.
decided to leave in December.
Right, there was meddling by the Chinese government.
Well, that was the allegation.
Allegation.
And I left earlier in September.
Mm-hmm. Why did you do that?
Well, I saw that the entire entrepreneurial landscape was mm-hmm. just burgeoning.
Right.
And
in China.
I lost all of my young, super smart staff. They were all mm-hmm. into startups, mm-hmm. all doing very well. VC industry was starting. the Chinese internet market as an independent market was taking off.
It really was right then.
So it was an exciting thing. I thought I wanted to be a part of
that. So you wanted to escape too at the same time.
Well, I didn't quite use the word escape.
Yeah. But Google, it was a big job running Google China.
It was a tremendous opportunity, but also frustrating at times.
Right.
But I compare that with having the freedom to invest in companies and help young entrepreneurs.
Right.
That seemed more fun.
So let's set the table then, because before that, China wasn't seen as the entrepreneurial engine that it is today, correct? Or it was just that was right around when it was really becoming clear.
I think that's reasonable to say. Actually, China's entrepreneurial energy started in the late 90s mm-hmm. with the portals.
Right.
And then later the search engine Alibaba were launched right. in the early 2000s.
Initially they were thought of as copies, correct? That was the generalized feeling that they copied U.S.
and
innovation.
And that's not an inaccurate
exactly.
statement.
Yeah, at that time.
At that time. Right.
And so there was an Alibaba that was like an Amazon. There was everything that was in the, there was a Baidu that was like a Google and various things like that. And many people had felt that that was the way it was going to be for China, that we're going to be fast followers, essentially.
I think that's the assumption, because in Silicon Valley, you know, copying is frowned upon mm-hmm. and it's viewed that once you copy, you always copy.
Right.
But I think those turned out to be wrong assumptions.
Yeah, absolutely. And then at the same time, Silicon Valley companies were having troubles and were operating in China. Can you talk about why that was? eBay had a disastrous run.
Yeah.
Yahoo was only successful because it bought a Chinese company, or it had a stake in a Chinese company.
I think the core reasons are numerous. Mm-hmm. First, the U.S. headquarters thought of China as just another market.
Mm-hmm.
So just take the product, it should work. Mm-hmm. It worked in Europe and Japan, should mm-hmm. work in China.
Mm-hmm.
But China was substantially different.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, some of the companies wanted to make money too early and too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think thirdly, the heads of these organizations, generally speaking, obviously there were exceptions, but mm-hmm. generally speaking, were no match for the local entrepreneurs.
Right.
The entrepreneurs, you know, they own 80% of the company.
Mm-hmm.
This was their one thing in their life that was going to make or break their whole career and future.
Mm-hmm.
They worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Right.
They did whatever it took to win.
Mm-hmm.
And then the multinationals had a normal professional lifestyle.
Business development.
Do business, do it the standard way, do it the corporate way. Don't offend the headquarter, do what headquarter wanted,
mm-hmm.
and don't contradict the headquarters, and hopefully get a promotion back mm-hmm. to the headquarters in 3 years.
Right.
And that mentality just had no chance of success.
So talk about why the Chinese market was different, because they did treat it. They had been had success going into Europe or Germany or wherever in those ways. What was the difference of the market?
Well, there's a difference then and difference now.
Mm-hmm.
The difference now is even more dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a parallel universe.
Mm-hmm.
So all the practices and assumptions you have in the U.S. will fail.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you're an app, you would expect to promote using Facebook, Snap, and so on in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But in China, none of those worked.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. is very well segmented companies with Google, Amazon, Facebook,
mm-hmm.
even each having clearly what they did
their
as
lane.
A separate, their lay of the land,
mm-hmm.
their piece. In China, everybody was competing with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
No one had any market for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to know the dynamics
right.
of what was happening and make the right bets. For example, you know, Alibaba had the entire payment that would seem like a phenomenal choke point.
Mm-hmm.
But all of a sudden, in 1 year, Tencent took almost half of that away
right.
from them.
Right.
So it's what I call in my book gladiatorial
mm-hmm.
kind of competition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you want to play in that game, first you have to be a gladiator.
Right.
Then you have to know how to work with the other gladiators
right.
and read the tea leaves on who's
right.
going to win.
Right.
Things change so much.
You can't treat it like it's a U.S. like a U.S. market. It's like its own market rather than a subsidiary market.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And also another huge difference is the Chinese companies go heavy,
mm-hmm.
right? The American companies like lightweight tech platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese companies are willing to hire 600,000 people
mm-hmm.
and to lower the cost of something. For
mm-hmm.
example, you know, compared with Yelp, OpenTable, mm-hmm. all very light platforms,
mm-hmm.
Meituan in China, they brought in 600,000 people to mm-hmm. ensure the delivery of a takeout order
mm-hmm.
is goes down to something like 70 cents per delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that completely changed the way Chinese people eat.
Right.
So that led to a very different model than what OpenTable and Yelp did.
Mm-hmm.
Those companies left the restaurant industry alone.
Mm-hmm.
Meituan basically disrupted the restaurant offline industry.
Right, right.
So how does an American company learn to play mm-hmm. in that kind of tough, tenacious, mm-hmm. disrupting market that left nothing alone?
And go to any length, in other words.
And competition can be very tough, dealing
right.
with challenges in the press and also users who are unhappy and false rumors being spread. And those are all mm-hmm. part of doing business
right.
in China.
And what about the government?
Well, that's
what they always point to. The government's not going to let us succeed here.
Yeah. Well, the government actually plays, I think, at this point, mm-hmm. a very modest part of difficulty of American companies going in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, some companies need to get a license.
Right.
But as we can see, Google's now got a Waymo license,
mm-hmm.
it
mm-hmm.
seems. Mm-hmm. Facebook is
maybe.
Trying.
Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
yeah.
And I think, it's not impossible to get a license.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, even if you get a license,
mm-hmm.
can an American company really learn to thrive in that environment?
In that environment.
Now, when I went as Google, the environment wasn't that tough and tenacious.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, I would say, a little different from the typical multinational
mm-hmm.
leader.
Mm-hmm.
I disagreed with headquarters at times
mm-hmm.
and made decisions that I thought was good for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our arguments and then we had some success. We gained market share from 9% to 24%. And on the way to become a $1 billion subsidiary. So the numbers were going in the right direction. And mm-hmm. I thought I was going to be the only one who may have a chance
mm-hmm.
to have at least a significant minority share.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Google, Uber, I think, had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
I think, Travis and his team were tenacious also.
Mm-hmm.
And that fit the Chinese spirit. But
mm-hmm.
ultimately, dealing with all the local issues, they
right.
ended up still losing to Didi.
Right. Right. When I say the government is that the government, one of the arguments that Silicon Valley companies make is that the government advantages Chinese mm-hmm. companies. How would you answer that?
I think that's very minimal
mm-hmm.
Because there are obviously licenses they can grant
mm-hmm.
or not grant.
Right.
Beyond that, well, China's part of the WTO.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point is also, I don't really see anything that they have done
mm-hmm.
to in the recent 10 years
mm-hmm.
that would show this. I think, I guess you could argue that American companies weren't going to succeed anyway,
mm-hmm.
so they don't have to do anything.
Right.
But in any case, I think the main issue today
was how they compete.
Is just that it's too hard.
It's too hard.
And I would also say that Chinese company coming to America would be equally hard.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just that the two ecosystems are so different.
Mm-hmm.
They're bound to continue to live in their independent parallel universes.
All right, let's get to AI in your book.
Okay.
Talk about the premise of your book, what you were trying to do. Now, since then, you've been investing. Give some examples of what you've been investing in at your venture company.
Okay. Well, we manage a total of about $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And AI is our largest portfolio,
mm-hmm.
about a third or so is
mm-hmm.
in AI.
When did you start doing that investing?
4 years ago.
4 years ago.
I think most of China caught the AI fever about 2 years ago. So
mm-hmm.
we were ahead
mm-hmm.
because we saw deep learning
mm-hmm.
was going to start making headways. So we have about 45 investments in AI. And we have 5 unicorns that are totally valued at about $23 billion.
Mm-hmm. So what were you looking for? Why were you ahead of the curve on that?
Well, we saw, for example, deep learning
mm-hmm.
was going to make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
We were very big on deep learning, computer vision, very early.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were among the first to go into autonomous vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that AI for finance was going to be a big segment.
Mm-hmm.
And then hardware and semiconductors was going to be an important area for China.
Mm-hmm.
So those were our fundamental bets and mm-hmm. the makeup of the 5 unicorns that we have.
Well, explain why, though. I want you to give me a deeper question. Why did you think that was the
okay.
bet to make?
Okay, so deep learning was the single biggest breakthrough in
mm-hmm.
AI
mm-hmm.
that made a machine learning possible on huge amounts of data with minimal human intervention.
Mm-hmm.
and it didn't need humans to tell features. It would discover them as long as there was enough data.
Right.
And China had so much data,
right.
So there's going to be somewhere it's going to tip.
Mm-hmm.
And we also saw that it's the people in computer vision mm-hmm. that invented deep learning.
Right.
So it's likely that computer vision would be the first area to tip, not speech recognition or something else.
Right.
So we made big bets in that area.
Mm-hmm.
The semiconductors, well, we saw the NVIDIA pricing,
mm-hmm.
and we knew that the Chinese companies would want alternatives.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways.
High prices, you mean?
Well, they sell the same product for very high prices for display
right.
versus AI.
Right.
And that high level of margin,
mm-hmm.
I think, leaves room for local competition.
To compete with NVIDIA.
Right. Not. I think it's hard to compete completely because
mm-hmm.
NVIDIA is a powerful company.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take one segment of the compute,
mm-hmm.
Let's say the inference, not
mm-hmm.
the training, or make it cheap in cell phones, devices,
right.
toys, where China is strong.
Mm-hmm.
So those were our investments in
mm-hmm.
semiconductors, in AI acceleration. Autonomous vehicles, I think, was an area there was a large number of people who decided to bet in the space.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a couple of really, really good teams. And we actually made 4 investments
mm-hmm.
in autonomous vehicles, not counting the sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And I continue to think that will be the largest disruption.
Mm-hmm.
Might take a little bit of time.
Right.
So we made 4 very good investments, one of which has become a unicorn. And the speed at which progress is made in that space is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
I think 2 years ago, 3 of the 4 companies started.
Mm-hmm.
And one could say they were 8 years behind Google.
Right.
Today, I think they're about 2 years behind Google.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah,
they're catching up very fast. The next 2 years may be harder, but
mm-hmm.
but they've caught in 2 years, they've caught up 6 years.
Right.
And then finance is the lowest hanging fruit
mm-hmm.
because finance is a numbers game.
Right.
And if AI is an objective function that optimizes profitability, lowers costs, improves margin for loans, credit card frauds, banks, insurance companies, that seemed like a no-brainer because you didn't have warehouses, manufacturing plant. You just plug in the algorithm and money comes out. You're
right.
printing money.
Right.
So we backed a couple of companies in that.
All right. We're here talking with Kai-Fu Lee. He is an investor in China. He's the CEO of Sinovation Ventures. His new book is called AI Superpowers. And when we get back, we're going to talk more about what that means.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything.
Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No, I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity.
It's me.
Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
We're here with Kai-Fu Lee. He is the CEO of Sinovation Ventures. He also ran China for Google for many years and worked for a number of other big tech companies in the U.S. His new book is called AI Superpowers. And the bottom part is China, Silicon Valley, and a new world order. Talk about what you mean by superpowers. You've done investments. You talked about your investments in the area, and you did it early and often. Talk about what you mean by superpowers and why that's important.
Yeah, I actually meant 3 things.
Okay.
Primarily, I meant China and U.S. will be by far the world's AI superpowers.
Right.
Because they'll possess the greatest value companies, people, data,
mm-hmm.
and IP. I also mean the companies such as Google, Facebook, Amazon,
mm-hmm.
Alibaba, Tencent will be superpowers because they started early and they benefit from the virtuous cycle
right.
of AI. And the third meaning is that AI itself is a superpower
mm-hmm.
in that it will create a wealth generation engine that we've never seen, but also potentially a job displacement engine
yes,
that we have to deal
about.
With.
Yeah. So talk about the first one. One of the things that a lot of people, I've been talking to a lot of people about is this idea of China moving forward rather quickly in AI, well past the U.S., a lot of having to do with data. Someone was asking me why Google's going to China, or I asked someone that, and they said data. That's it. Data is the problem. They don't have enough. China has more. And with some of the, we'll talk about the surveillance and facial recognition things where they just have data coming out of their eyeballs in China, essentially, comparatively. So talk about that competition, because a lot of people feel the U.S. is going to decline in that area pretty quickly because of the lack of data.
Yeah, so I clearly believe in the power of data because deep learning simply works with more data.
Yes.
You take any three or four variants of the algorithm, one thing for sure is you pump a lot more data at it, it works better.
Right.
That's the primary reason that speech recognition, vision, and others have improved a lot. Mm-hmm. And China has so much more data, not just in terms of number of people in market. Mm-hmm. For example, China's fully connected with mobile payment.
Right.
So 700 million people, mm-hmm. Most of the Chinese population, can pay each other with two buttons mm-hmm. on the phone with almost no commission and as little as 15 cents. Mm-hmm. And that level of universality of transaction
right.
will create so much data mm-hmm. that can be used by Tencent and Alibaba
for
mining insights, right. targeting, and so on,
right.
but can also be used by individual merchants or apps who have transactions. Mm-hmm. If you had a retail store, before you had faceless people who bought stuff.
Right.
Now you know who bought what, and you right. can suddenly do much better inventory prediction, sales forecast, and mm-hmm. so on. So that's just one example. But if you move forward to, you know, China has 10 times more takeouts mm-hmm. than the U.S. Mm-hmm. for food delivery. It has 300 times more in shared bicycle rides.
Mm-hmm.
It has, I think, 4 times more in shared car rides.
Mm-hmm.
And all these standard numbers are larger, more than the ratio of the internet population,
mm-hmm.
simply because the usage of mobile was stronger, more sticky in China.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also going offline because a number of health clinics and autonomous stores, autonomous fast food,
mm-hmm.
shopping malls, and of course airports, train stations are hooked up with all kinds of sensors.
Mm-hmm.
And the sensors might track motion, heat, cameras, mm-hmm. microphones. And these will send
also
up data.
Lots of data.
They'll send up data, not raw data, but
mm-hmm.
data that's relevant,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Such as a user picked up this product and frowned and didn't buy it.
Well, people have... There's more nefarious uses of that data, obviously. But one of the things that they were talking about is that in this country, they wouldn't, the allowance of sensors and facial mm-hmm. recognition is going to see a much rougher road because of mm-hmm. consent, all kinds mm-hmm. of things, where that's not the case in China. And so they can suck up so much data about people's movements, their faces, their activities that they couldn't do here, that companies like Google and others are hindered. Most people feel it's a good thing that they're hindered.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Well, I think the Chinese users have a stronger willingness to exchange the capture of certain data
mm-hmm.
if, in return, there is value to be provided.
Mm-hmm.
For example, greater security, lower crime rates,
mm-hmm.
or possibly convenience.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the Chinese people care about privacy. There
mm-hmm.
are people raising awareness. But I think at the current level of deployment, people accept the trade-off
mm-hmm.
that is being offered.
Mm-hmm. And I think the worries about the government observing people is mm-hmm. well-founded, correct or not?
I think that's a very popular feeling in the West,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm. And which would hinder the West from collecting data in a good way. People in the West think that.
Well, I think the people in the West would generally not adopt the widespread censors
right.
Used by government.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, also, the private companies would have a hard time putting it
yeah.
in stores.
Right.
I don't know how Amazon Go is
mm-hmm.
perceived because
mm-hmm.
they have those cameras.
Yes, they do. People are wary of it. People are wary of Nest. People are wary of all the different products that they are trying to insert in the home and everywhere else. And there's always
yeah.
some complaint about them.
Yeah, well, I think there's also a lot of good that could come from this deployment.
All right, talk about that.
Well, in hospitals,
mm-hmm.
you can prevent sick people, elderly people from falling down. You can call alarms for them.
Mm-hmm.
Crime rate, we've talked about. Autonomous stores, you can essentially turn an offline store into an online store
mm-hmm.
by capturing user preferences.
Mm-hmm.
And at schools, I think parents in China are likely to give consent for cameras at school,
mm-hmm.
not for surveillance, but for giving teachers feedback
mm-hmm.
on where how to improve the kids' performance, where
mm-hmm.
they might be getting lost.
Mm-hmm.
So hospitals, clinics, and elderly homes, and
mm-hmm.
so on. So there are applications I think the West would find useful as well. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think those would have a hard time getting launched here.
Right, and the mentality is definitely different, which I think it depends on what you think about it. So talk a little bit about where AI is going. And so here you have all these major investments. You've made billions of dollars in investments in this area, as have many others. Where are the trends going in AI?
Well, we see four waves of AI, mm-hmm. all really just at the very beginnings. Mm-hmm. One is using AI in internet. Mm-hmm. The other is using it in businesses. Mm-hmm. So for business intelligence, banks, insurance companies, and basically all corporations to automate the middle person out of mm-hmm. the system. The third wave, we think, is adding eyes and ears, mm-hmm. what we were just talking sensors. About, the sensors. Mm-hmm. And we think that will create a lot of new applications that mm-hmm. didn't exist before.
Right.
Because previously, those visual data, were discarded. They mm-hmm. became transient, but now they could be captured and something could be done, you know, smart cities and so on. And then lastly, we see autonomous AI, mm-hmm. and that is when AI gets arms and legs. Mm-hmm. They may not be maybe wheels, but they can move around, manipulate in factories, manufacturing, in farms for picking fruits, mm-hmm. in commercial applications like washing dishes, mm-hmm. and also eventually in the home for mm-hmm. education, toys, and also eventually there will be housework mm-hmm. robots.
Right.
All of these will happen along with autonomous vehicles mm-hmm. that will begin in non-public roads, then going into highways, and then going into all the roads, and then going from L3 to L4, mm-hmm. and that will lead to another wave of changes. So we see great investment opportunities in all four waves, mm-hmm. and no doubt there will be a fifth, sixth, seventh wave, which we just don't know what they are
yet. What are you thinking that might be?
Well, I think a delegation interface with a smart assistant mm-hmm. that has an infinite memory mm-hmm. to enhance us, you know, without any of this hardware intrusion, but just as an augmentation mm-hmm. of our physical limitation.
Okay.
That could be a
that
next
means
one.
Not something. Remember, Google had the eyeball thing and the ear thing. Not that. That it would be part of your.
Have you seen the Black Mirror episode?
Yes, of course, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. The eyes being.
Yeah, that one that it remembers everything you saw and heard.
Yeah, through
and
your eye.
Can index it.
Right.
Obviously, that has also dystopian and worrisome mm-hmm. outcomes.
Yeah, the guy took it out at the end.
Yes, but mm-hmm. But it may not be that instantiation. Mm-hmm. But we people are limited in mm-hmm. our ability to remember. Mm-hmm. That's our faultiest part of our brain.
Right.
And computers are perfect.
I was just saying this to someone the other day, something I wanted to, I wish I could have remembered this.
Yeah.
My son was asking me about it, something, and I was like, I just don't remember it.
Happens all the time.
I have a vague memory of it, or yes. if at all, if it's the correct memory or if it's not the correct memory. It was an interesting discussion I ended up having with my son.
Right.
And beyond that?
Well, beyond that, whether we believe in AGI, general mm-hmm. AI or not, mm-hmm. I'm in the camp that feels that's very distant, mm-hmm. many decades
Explain
away.
Explain that for who?
Well, AGI means having AI be like humans, mm-hmm. Have the common sense, mm-hmm. Cross-domain ability to reason and plan, mm-hmm. and then one step further, maybe even with self-awareness and mm-hmm. emotions. Mm-hmm. I feel...
Cyborgs,
right?
Right.
So some people, like Ray Kurzweil, mm-hmm. project that's coming in 2029.
Mm-hmm. It's not.
I think not. Yeah. I think the number of breakthroughs that would be needed mm-hmm. would be probably another dozen deep mm-hmm. learning level breakthrough.
Right.
And if you look at the last 60 years, we've mm-hmm. had one deep learning level breakthrough. Mm-hmm. So when will the 12 come? Mm-hmm. Maybe 720
so
years.
So of the ones you're talking about, all these different AI waves, which give me time frames on a lot of them, on the first four.
The first three have already happened. Internet mm-hmm. AI is all around us. Mm-hmm. Business AI is being implemented, mm-hmm. but requires a large amount of data. So mm-hmm. it's going to be, you know, the large banks that start and so on. Mm-hmm. The visual is, I think, starting in China, mm-hmm. less so in the US. The spoken is happening in both China and U.S. Mm-hmm. Amazon Alexa is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. They're a Chinese equivalent of that. Autonomous vehicles, I think, are already happening in non-public
sure.
roads.
You yeah. know,
shuttles, forklifts, smart robots, Kiva inside Amazon and the mm-hmm. Chinese equivalent.
Kivas. People never pay attention. I pay a lot of attention to Kiva.
Sure, sure.
I absolutely. When they bought that, I was like, oh, wow, that's an interesting change.
And I think the natural next step is to have another robot pick out
100%.
Yeah, 100%.
I was at the Amazon warehouse in Kent, and they were using the Kiva robots, and there was a guy, the Kiva robot would bring over the stuff, and then the guy would pick it out, and I said, "You're finished." And he's like, "What?" And I'm like, I don't want to explain what's about to happen to you.
That's right.
Before I get to the issue of work, how do you look at U.S. companies right now, having worked for all of them? What do you think, where they are?
Well, I think the Silicon Valley style of entrepreneurship mm-hmm. is still the world's leading mm-hmm. Way of building companies. Mm-hmm. It's vision-driven, focuses on tech, tends to go deeply to solve problems, and has strong culture and value that makes them are built to last. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of respect for all the companies I work for. Mm-hmm. I also think China is emerging right. with a kind of a new way to build companies mm-hmm. of running as fast as you can mm-hmm. and always assume someone's going to eat your lunch, and so you better eat theirs first. And it's a very scrappy, tenacious competition.
That used to winner be take Silicon all. Valley, correct or not?
Did it?
It wasn't. Did you not think? We're too soft, right?
I think there were days when Microsoft was pointed and considered that way.
And then?
And then Microsoft became kinder and gentler, right?
Right. Yeah, they had to. They yes. were forced into it by the yes. government. Yeah.
Right.
Was that a bad thing?
I think it's not good or bad. It's just different.
Yeah.
Because China is such a big market mm-hmm. and there's so much capital going in mm-hmm. and the people who've made the right investments have made so much money mm-hmm. and the market kept growing, at least up till now, all those things incentivize this behavior. Also, keep in mind, Deng Xiaoping about 40 years ago said he will change the economic system by letting some people get rich first. Mm-hmm. So there's a rush mm-hmm. for the Chinese in the last 40 years to be among the first, because mm-hmm. otherwise you may not be among those.
Right, 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 absolutely.
So I think all of those pointed is almost a system constructed mm-hmm. with just the right elements.
Right.
And that's what in the last 10 years turned it from a copycat
right.
to an innovative country.
Are U.S. tech companies now too soft? Are they too rich? Do they have too many private planes?
I don't think that's the issue.
No.
That maybe that's an issue. I think mm-hmm. the Chinese tycoons buy just as many private jets.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah, but let's say we found an internet population in Mars, mm-hmm. and we're going to land the two top entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley and two top from China and let them compete to mm-hmm. see who can win the Martians. Mm-hmm. I would bet on the side of the Chinese entrepreneurs.
Because
they're faster, more tenacious, more understanding of mm-hmm. user needs and willing to build products for user needs mm-hmm. rather than what Steve Jobs says. Right. I look in the mirror and that's my user understanding.
Right, right. That's his user. That's really interesting.
It's
also
brilliant, but it's hard.
But, the kombucha from the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs would be better. and the various foods and things like that. I'm only teasing.
Yeah, it could be.
So let's talk about the impact of AI on jobs, because I think this is something that American companies or tech companies are facing, this idea that what they're doing. Right now, they're in the midst of, did they kill democracy? And they were just having hearings, for example, we were just listening to. But one of the things has been this discussion of the future of work.
Right.
So what does AI mean for that, from your perspective?
Well, I think there are a lot of simple kind of one sentence answers,
right.
None of which I think are right.
Okay.
Some people said it's all purely a human amplifier. Some people said, oh, it's just going to make us better. Others said, no, it's going to take all the jobs away. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be different, depends on what jobs you have. Mm-hmm. If we look at what AI cannot do, there are really two main things. One is creative jobs, mm-hmm. Jobs like yours, jobs like scientists, storytellers, artists and so on. And the other are the compassionate people who really create a human-to-human connection,
right.
trust.
Until they get the robot eyes right, and then they will.
Well, I think the robots will always mess up. Mm-hmm. And when robots mess up, they mess up badly.
See, I think we should put robotic things in people and then not. Instead of making robots try to be like people, we should make people try to be like robots. It's a big thought, actually. Just think about it. Think about it. We spend all our time trying to get a robot to open a door, and everyone goes, wow, it opened a door.
Yeah, yeah.
Why bother? Just put robotic things in people.
That's right. My favorite example is elderly care. Mm-hmm. All these people building robots to take care of old people. We should take care of our parents.
We just can't get people.
And if we don't, then we should hire a person to. Mm-hmm. None of our parents want to be taken care of by a robot. Mm-hmm. So we should, I agree with you. I get what you're saying.
But I'm saying put robotic things in the caregivers. Anyway,
okay,
it's a bigger idea. I'm too genius for you.
No, I get it. So you want the human caregiver, but maybe with super strong arms that can prevent the fall.
Yeah, like instead of spending our time trying to get a robot to open a door. Come on, why bother? We know a man or a woman can open a door.
Okay.
So that's already solved. So in any case.
Okay.
So now we give them eyes and ears and things like that, and extra lifting and exoskeletons and things like that.
I see. Yeah. I see. Right. So coming back to my thoughts, so the human connection is hard. So what will happen? So if we make a quadrant of four types of jobs, I think the lower left quadrant is the low compassion, low empathy, low creativity.
Right.
All those jobs will be taken by AI.
Name those jobs. Those are
beginning
jobs.
With, factory jobs, starting with inspection, going into assembly, starting with dishwashing, going into flipping hamburgers and simple
cooking. There's a robot hamburger place here in San Francisco now.
Right, absolutely.
Called the Creator.
And we invested in a Chinese noodle robot, too.
Okay.
And then there are also white-collar jobs that will be replaced.
So where sector is that? That's staying in the low. That's in the same sector.
Yeah, basically traders, they're already gone, right? And then a city said they're going to remove 10,000 of their operational staff. And even before that, telesales, telemarketing, customer reps, the jobs currently outsourced to India. And the current manufacturing jobs or outsourced to China.
Right.
Both sets of those will be challenged. I would argue white-collar ones first because that's software only.
Right.
So that's a lower left quadrant.
Name those jobs, lawyers, possible doctors.
Not yet. The lower left corner, those are more the inspection, assembly line, telemarketing, customer service. Those are in danger because they were low human touch and low creativity.
And data rich.
Data rich, exactly. And routine in nature. And then the upper left quadrant would be lower creativity, but lots of compassion. I think those jobs will flourish. And in fact, I think migration needs to go from lower left to upper left. So, for example, the doctor's job will probably change because the medical diagnosis will become very, very good.
Right, and then through AI.
Through AI. And then the doctor is more of a human connector. And then maybe just 4 years of college is enough. Maybe nurse practitioners can become doctors. Maybe there's more training about how to comfort and how to tease out from the patient what are you really feeling, what
because
are your symptoms.
Because diagnostics should be done by AI, like radiology, for example. I always use the radio, like that you don't need a radiologist. They're not accurate compared to
the
AI.
That's right. Well, it takes time, but eventually they'll be displaced in terms of...
All of diagnostics, it seems.
Eventually, take 20, 30 years, but one segment at a time. So doctors can become this compassionate profession, and we might have 10 times more doctors because the cost of medical care will go down. Poor people can access it, and then you can still have real super experts that you pay a lot of money for, but most healthcare... so more doctors could be employed, but not the same kind of doctors today. The same could be applied to many other areas like professionals, you know, wealth planners, teachers in particular. You probably
talk about that.
What I think a lot of what teachers do are routine. So grading homeworks, grading exams, giving us exams, giving the same lecture and then again, those can be done by AI or MOOC. And what the teacher should do is one-on-one, targeted, finding out what your passion is, guiding you, coaching you, become your mentor for life. And that could be one-to-one. That could be homeschooling. That could be public school, but one-to-one ratio. So teacher numbers could blossom. So I think teacher and doctors are more, require a lot of training. There will be other less trained jobs. For example, elderly care. We're going to have a lot more older people. People over 80 requires five times as much care. And we want people to take care of them. And elderly care is a very difficult to fill job because it's not paid well, nor does it have a high social status. And I think those need to be changed so that when people come off the assembly line and telemarketing jobs they could move into, either an elderly care type of a job mm-hmm. or a teacher type of a job, depending on their aptitude.
Right.
And then the right side are the creative jobs. So mm-hmm. that's a sigh of relief. We're okay. Mm-hmm. The creative jobs without too much compassion, empathy needed, they can use AI as a tool. Mm-hmm. Scientists can find more drugs with AI filtering right. for them. And their power will be amplified, mm-hmm. symbiotic combination. Mm-hmm. And then the upper right will be high empathy and high creativity. And those are what will make humans shine.
So what does that mean politically and for the countries, these countries, including China? Because there's a lot of, rote manufacturing sure. jobs there. There's a lot. And you've thrown people at it, and yeah. that, which is why it's lower cost, and which is why Apple and others have moved manufacturing there. What happens? Because there is a social crisis that can result in this.
I think the bigger crisis is social more than financial mm-hmm. because it's not just a question of losing a job and getting some social welfare, UBI, mm-hmm. to pay for you. Mm-hmm. It's that people have attached the meaning of their lives to their work.
Right.
And when the work is gone, mm-hmm. so is the meaning. Mm-hmm. So I think it's imperative that governments start to understand how to redistribute mm-hmm. the money mm-hmm. so that there's enough money to take care of this set of people who need to make a transition.
Right.
And then there needs to be retraining and the incentives mm-hmm. put in place so the migration can happen.
Do you think government has that capability? I don't.
I think...
They don't know how Facebook works.
I think very few governments have that capability. Mm-hmm. I think we can start with something small. Mm-hmm. For example, rather than give everybody a tax break, mm-hmm. give it to those who homeschool, mm-hmm. give it to those who are doing volunteer work, mm-hmm. give it to those who take early retirement, but put their time in a socially meaningful. Mm-hmm. So there can be smaller steps. Vocational training should change. Mm-hmm. We should have fewer auto mechanics courses, mm-hmm. but maybe more plumber courses, because right. plumber is not a job that robots can do yeah. soon. Yeah. And we already know which jobs mm-hmm. are going to be on the decline. Mm-hmm. So the vocational schools should follow this projection of job increase or decrease mm-hmm. based on automation. Mm-hmm. So those are things that can be done by any government. I think potentially governments like China may be able to make bigger steps with distribution.
More control over.
Chinese government has historically been effective mm-hmm. in pushing one segment to another. Mm-hmm. The Chinese agriculture to manufacturing shift was done faster mm-hmm. with a lot of chaos, but right. still more effectively than probably any other country. Mm-hmm. So there might be a different
How do you
example.
Assess the U.S.'s commitment to this? I don't think there's any. I don't even...
I don't think the current administration acknowledges that mm-hmm. this is happening. I've right. seen some top officials say the AI job displacement is 50 years away,
mm-hmm.
and
yes,
that would be worrisome.
That was the Treasury Secretary.
That was
the Treasury Secretary, but yes. he's an imbecile. So what do you do then? What does that bring again the U.S. behind again? Because they'll be losing these jobs because that's the way it's going to go without any preparation for the future.
Well, my guess is that when there will be some profession that's suddenly disrupted mm-hmm. and millions of people are out of their jobs, and then that will wake up the government. That's
Which
my
one?
Guess. I don't know, but possibly the danger is it might be one of the outsourced jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's
you
not
won't see it.
The paying is in India, not mm-hmm. in China.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. So finishing up, let's talk a little bit about what that means for the creators of these technologies. Do you have a responsibility as someone who funds them to figure that part out?
I think I do.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us try to contribute differently.
Mm-hmm.
There are those who advocate the UBI.
Mm-hmm.
I do not.
Universal basic income.
Yes.
Why is that?
I do not, because I think that doesn't solve the meaning problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're just giving people to money as mm-hmm. a anesthesia
mm-hmm.
for pain.
That's a really
and
good way to put it.
Doesn't get them over the mm-hmm. really true problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of us are thinking of ideas, and that's good. And I think all of us are willing to contribute, whether it's by taxation or by donation or by foundations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those of us in investment, we could look more at investment that create jobs,
mm-hmm.
Still make money, but maybe not as much as the
right.
AI companies.
Right.
So I think it's imperative for all of us to do what we can without expecting the government to do it all,
mm-hmm.
which is why I wrote this book, mm-hmm. so that the awareness would be there, but the call to action is up to the individuals.
Up to the individual companies. Do you think they have that commitment?
I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic, too, because in Silicon Valley, I think all the talks about UBI suggest that people want to do something.
Yeah.
Whether we think that one will work or not, it's still very respectable that they are thinking ahead.
And when you look forward 20 years, what are the jobs you think will be the most important?
I think the creative jobs will be the most important. I think a lot of people who could have been creative were stifled over the last 100 years because they weren't the highest paying jobs.
Right.
They were forced into some relatively more routine job that paid more. But I think now we can really have a chance to release our potential in creativity. And I think the empathetic jobs, human jobs, will also be important because that's the only job type that can absorb the exodus and the displacement that will happen in the routine jobs.
Last question, I'm going to put you on the spot. If you had to pick one U.S. company and one Chinese company that you find, a large one or a small one, we'll do each of those that you're most impressed with right now, what would they be?
Most impressed U.S. company would be Alphabet, Google.
Because
of its aspiration, because that it tries to stick with its values. You know, we may or may not agree with it, but that it tries to do that. And also because of the phenomenal creativity from the company.
And their most important part, Waymo? What, cloud?
I think Waymo is most interesting to me. But I think a lot of the new healthcare initiatives are interesting as well.
Okay.
The Chinese company would be a tie between Alibaba and Tencent. I think Alibaba has demonstrated that a company can grow so big and still top-level people feel empowered like they own the company. And that kind of cultural strength will probably give it legs to go to the next level. I don't see that in other companies. Alphabet obviously is trying to do that with different segments. But Alibaba, if you really go in, each of the 25 CEOs really feels like a CEO. And they're still working like startups. So they maintain the culture, and that's expandable. That doesn't fall apart with size. I also respect Tencent a great deal because they're one of the very few companies that could build a product to disrupt itself. They had QQ, which was the dominant messenger. And then they allowed WeChat to be built and to disrupt QQ. But QQ didn't die. QQ kind of became the Snapchat of China, appealing to the younger generation. So a company that can tolerate two camps to compete and both actually continue to be successful, that's really rare to see.
What about startup that you find?
There are many great startups. We fund VIP Kid, which is an aspirational education company that connects American English teachers to Chinese students. It's essentially the Uber for education. And when everyone thinks education is not going to create unicorns, VIP Kid has really proved them wrong. And now they're using technology and AI. They're also using pro bono to give the English teachers a chance to give some hours to teach poorer kids in a group. And I think it's a company that thinks far ahead and more likely to disrupt education than some of the American education companies that have a big aspiration, but it's too difficult to implement.
Absolutely. That's really interesting. All right. This has been fascinating. Kai-Fu, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
Kai-Fu Lee's book is called AI Superpowers, China, Silicon Valley, and the New World Order, and it's available now. If you enjoyed this interview as much as I did, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find more episodes of Recode Decode on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you didn't like this interview, I, again, do not care. You can just say, if you just want to say hi, tweet at me. I'm at Kara Swisher on Twitter. Now that you're done with this, go check out our latest episode of Recode Media. You can find that show wherever you found this one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode. Thanks to our editor, Joel Robbie, and our producer, Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Wednesday. Tune in then.